We are live from New York. It's Saturday night. I think we did that the last one.
Didn't we? Oh, yeah, we did. And we tried to figure out who that voice was.
Yeah. And he died or something like
that. He died relatively recently.
Yeah.
So I don't know who it was.
No. Yeah, I don't either.
Could just look it up right now, but I'm not going to. We're not going to repeat bits here.
Yeah, we don't do that.
Are these cookies, like, stale?
No, those cookies are good. We're sponsored by Stella Doro cookies today.
Stella Doro.
Your Italian aunt's favorite. They always have
that shit. She's got it in the cupboard. Just trust us on this one.
Yeah, they are there somewhere in the house. Otherwise, she will be deported immediately.
Even if she was born here, it does not matter.
It does not matter. No, sir.
Every Italian is subject to a stop and frisk.
The Stella Doro audit. With those other cookies they get from the fucking, like, delis. The ones that are, like, really dense. But that are really fucking good.
I don't really know what you're talking about.
They have, like, usually, like, half of them will be, like, dipped in chocolate.
Oh, the black and whites?
No. No.
Oh, okay.
They're, like, little mounds. They, like, ridges on them, and like half will be dipped in like chocolate, and the other half will be like completely just flavorless, very chalky, like dense cookie.
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
You don't know what I'm talking about? What the fuck?
There's quite a few cookies that could probably be described in a similar fashion.
Are there?
Yeah, I feel like.
I don't know. I'm doing a quick search for it. I don't see them. Damn it.
Owned.
Now these Italians. Oh. They look kind of like, they're like this.
Oh, yeah. Those shits suck, dude.
Yeah, they're kind of bad, but they also kind of slap.
Like, if I want to eat a crumbly, dry, fucking,
they are so crumbly, aren't they?
Flavorless cookie, then sign me up for one of them. But
and otherwise, you're not a fan of anise either, are
no,
you?
No, I'm not. That shit is too strong.
I like anise. It's and like those Italians love making anise cookies.
Yeah, they do.
They're fucking good, in my opinion.
The Italian cookie game, it's pretty weak, man. I'm sorry.
Stella Doro's.
These are good.
They are all right. They are all right. Have you ever had one of the like rainbow ones?
No, I have not.
I haven't either. I don't know what they would even be remotely like. Are thumbprints Italians?
Like the peanut butter cookies?
No. Like the with the like apricot like preserve in the middle or raspberry or whatever.
I don't know.
Is that an Italian joint? Most popular Italian cookies.
Oh, let's see it.
This is recording, right? Okay.
Yeah, this is gold right here.
Tegol Valdostan.
Never even heard of that.
Know what the fuck that is. Not interested. Amaretti di Gallarotti. Amaretto is a liquor. It's like an almond liqueur.
So it's probably almonds.
Yeah, probably almonds. That's another thing Italians love.
Biscotti. Nah, that shit slaps.
Biscotti. Is biscotti a cookie?
Oh.
I think we're stretching the boundaries of a cookie here.
I don't even know. I mean, I guess you could just say it's a pastry, but that feels a little.
I mean, I feel like out. I don't. I might expose myself here. I don't really know anything about the process of making a biscotti, but to me it looks like more like a bread.
You're exposing yourself as not knowing how to make biscotti.
Yeah.
Just a lethal sort of miscalculation by Zach. Oh,
no doubt be canceled for this.
It does look like bread. Doesn't taste at all like bread or like feel like bread.
You know what? I don't know if I've ever had a biscotti.
Really?
Actually, that's a lie. I definitely have. Actually, that's definitely a lie because I actually had some good ass biscotti from a place in Pittsburgh. I forget what it was called.
I used to go to, there was the Crazy Mocha in Squirrel Hill. I used to go down there and, like, on weekends and shit, do, like, homework and get, like, a cup of coffee or, like, a tea or whatever and some biscotti. That shit was always really good.
How about, okay, so how about this?
Oh, what the COVID has taken from us.
This is, so this is Taste Atlas I'm looking at, and it's the top 50 Italian cookies. And they are fucked up because they categorize them by region as well. So, like, we have Amoretti's from Piedmont, we have Amoretti's from Lazio.
Oh, boy.
From Genoa, and those are all considered different things, I guess, which is, like...
Folks, let's streamline it a little bit, guys. Yeah,
I mean, not extremely, like, approachable, but also a reminder, the nation of Italy, not been around as long as we may like to think. But
for very diverse locales.
I wonder if Italy will ever go the route of, like, Catalan or Basque. Like impending independence.
Like, Naples is sick of... There's a bit in Sopranos. It was, really? Well, because one of the characters... Well, there's one episode where, like, Tony goes to Italy or whatever and talks to, like, the mob guys over there to set up, like, a trade deal. I think they, like, move, like, Mercedes or whatever back and forth. And one of the guys from that mob, Furio, who's awesome. He's the best. He's such a pure soul.
We get it.
He, the Italian guy, he comes back and just, like, works with Tony and the Soprano family and stuff in New Jersey or whatever. And then there's one episode that was all about Columbus Day. And it's always...
I think that's like an infamous episode of
Soprano. It's a really good episode, but it's, so all of the fucking, like, Jersey, like, mob guys are sitting outside of Satriali's deli or whatever, and they're just like shooting the shit, and like, you see, like, Silvio is like, you see this shit about the Columbus Day protests that they're planning or whatever, and they're all like, oh, that's bullshit, and Columbus, he's a hero, he's an Italian American icon, this is the anti-Italian attitude. And Furio, who is actually Italian, he's like, fuck Columbus, he's from where's Columbus from?
I don't fucking know.
He's like, he's from Naples or whatever. Fuck the Napoli people or whatever. And it's just this great moment that's like, oh, fucking Italian Americans are like basically role playing.
Yeah.
Like being Italian and like a monolithic sort of Italian culture that like somebody like Columbus can stand in to like represent. Sopranos, really smart show with about like really dumb characters.
But I wonder if that's going to be if that's going to take root in the aftermath of,
let's break up Germany first.
In the aftermath of the nothing inevitable, good
has come since Germany has unified.
Well, that's okay. I don't know the different German states.
There's Bavaria.
Mm-hmm.
There's
Deutschland. That's just Germany.
I think that's just Germany.
Yeah.
The Rhine. Land?
Maybe.
I don't know what the fuck that is, but I feel like I've heard it in reference to Central Europe.
Yeah, sure. We'll see. We'll count it.
Anyway, there's a lot of them.
Anyway, the inevitable Scottish independence that's screaming down our path, screaming that we're racing towards, will no doubt be followed by Catalonian independence in Spain, and then Basque independence in Spain. And I wonder if Italy's going to follow. I feel like there hasn't been any, like, I don't know anything about the current state of Italian politics or society writ large or anything like that. But I wonder if the Italians will be like,
they just see, like, all
we're these Genoese, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Scotti del Legaccio.
Legosi.
No, Legaccio. Comes from Genoa. And this blurb, someone answering our question of is biscotti bread, says that it is categorized somewhere between a cookie and a rusk. R-U-S-K.
What the fuck is that?
Don't know what that could possibly be.
All right, so they didn't really answer our question at all.
No, but it's whatever that is. Cucidati. Okay. Oh boy, I don't know. How would you even pronounce that? That just looks Greek.
That's all Greek to me.
Panatigi. It means. Okay. Whoa. This is fucked up. Oh, this comes from Modica.
Oh boy. No. It's close to home.
Yeah. Oh, no. For listeners, Jake and I are Italian of the Modica variety. Panettiere are small crescent-shaped, thin-crusted cookies filled with a mixture of sugar, chocolate, almonds, lemon peel, eggs, cinnamon, vanilla.
Sounds wow, all right. That sounds delicious.
And one slightly unusual ingredient, ground beef.
You could have given me like 100 guesses and I would never have assumed, never have gotten there. That's disgusting. What the fuck is wrong with them?
Maybe it's like a mole type of, like, appeal.
Like, well, mole is usually like spicy as well.
But so chocolate and like, you know, your carne asada or whatever. I don't know, man.
That sounds vile.
I didn't really expect that, but
way to ruin a good thing.
Yeah, had
going
there. Italians. Couldn't just stick with the fucking killer combos you had working. All right, sorry. I'm working down the list quick now. Anicini seems whatever. Oh my god, does this just end? Next page. What the fuck? Okay. The top 10. We're in the top 10.
Now you have to go through individual pages.
Biscotti al coco. Does look all right. It's coconut biscotti. Tozzetti. Those seem fine. Cavallucci. Okay. Sure. Amaretti di Serrano. Whatever. Cantuccini Toscani. Canestrelli. Italians fucking just love butter cookies. Ladyfingers are Italian.
Okay.
That's a positive.
Well, that's kind of what these are.
Yeah, I guess it is. Ricciarelli di Siena. Amaretti's. I think we've had all these fucking Amaretti's. Okay. Whatever. What are we here to talk just about today, Jake?
We are here to talk about something very different from Italian pastries and desserts.
That's right.
Not quite different enough to talk about buildings.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get to that. It's coming. Just wait.
Yes.
We are here to talk about a little peculiar film from 1962 called The Manchurian Candidate. You would have thought that maybe if we were better at doing this whole thing, we could have like had an opening sort of like bit that led quite naturally into the topic at hand, but
no,
we did not. Yeah, so The Manchurian Candidate, directed by John Frankenheimer. Oh, here's the link. Speaking of Italian stuff, Frank Sinatra's in this bad boy.
Ooh, that's a good. There we go.
It's not that good, but okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. So I bought the Criterion Collection of this Blu-ray of this like a while ago, actually. We just got around to watching it a few days back. And it's a very interesting movie.
It's a very interesting film.
Zach, don't you agree?
Very cool movie, Jake.
Yes. How many thumbs up do you give it?
I give it 2 thumbs up. I like this movie a lot. I thought it was very, very cool. Here is the rundown. It is starring Frank Sinatra in the only movie I've ever watched with Frank Sinatra.
He was in an assload of fucking movies.
He was, wasn't he?
Yeah. Back in like the 40s and 50s and stuff. Never would have thought.
It's starring Lawrence Harvey, who I'm convinced is not an American actor.
I could almost guarantee he's British.
I can't tell if he was in like playing down an accent just poorly, or if they just didn't mind that he was speaking with an accent during the movie, but
he has a very like sophisticated,
very like, 50s
aristocratic like mid-Atlantic accent.
Yeah, which was cool. I guess he was great in this movie though.
He was fucking fantastic.
I thought he was awesome. I literally do not know what else he's been in, but
I don't either.
He was really good. Stars Janet Leigh in a very strange role that I want to touch on.
Yes.
A little bit later.
Post Psycho, Janet Leigh.
She was in Psycho?
Yep, she's Marion Crane.
She's the one who gets... She's that bitch who gets killed in the shower.
Killed. She gets, that's right.
Get she killed. Does. Lawrence Harvey is British. And Angela...
I know how to call him.
What? What the fuck did you just say?
That was back before British actors knew how to talk in American ways.
Now they're too good at it.
Yeah. Now you can't tell who's who.
Yeah. They don't like it. And Angela Lansbury.
Who's fucking awesome.
The queen herself.
The queen of diamonds. Some might say.
She is a stone cold bitch in this movie.
She's on fire.
She is absolutely chewing up and spitting everybody out. Brief rundown of the plot, I suppose. It's kind of a convoluted one.
It's very convoluted.
So,
but the central sort of the like device at the core of it is like something that has like obviously by osmosis like transferred into like mainstream cultural consciousness. Just like, oh, that's just something we all like understand, which is weird because like I feel like this movie is not really talked about a whole lot anymore.
I wouldn't say it's talked about, but like you're saying, like I feel like Manchurian Candidate is a pretty like, you know, is a shorthand now for a specific like person because of this movie,
idea
or a specific like concept because of this movie,
which of course is the idea of someone being brainwashed by opposing forces and turned into basically an unknowing assassin. Which so, fucking owns.
And this movie, so we're gonna get into the briefest of synopses, I guess, here, but this movie did predate the JFK assassination.
JFK, RFK.
Predated the, like, all of the conspiratorial sort of, like, history of the 60s. Even really predated, like, the onset of the anti-war sentiment in 62 this came out. So it was kind of a precursor to a lot of the ideas that it kind of stumbled itself into. Maybe not stumbled, because I feel like I think the movie's very intentional, the story's very intentional, but like it definitely I guess foreshadowed would be a better word.
Yeah,
this like decade of like very strange, like sort of upturning of geopolitical sort of like activity.
It's very strange to consider this movie in its historical context.
Yeah.
Because I mean, like, it makes perfect sense that it would come out when it came out.
Yeah.
Because like, I think literally in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis, it released.
Yeah. Right.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
Sort of. I mean, it can't have been that far removed from, like, Doctor Strangelove. But to just, like, think about, like, how it basically, it, like, it doesn't, like, I don't even know if it predicts necessarily, but, and, like, like, all of the, like, CIA stuff in, like, the late 60s and 70s and stuff, it's so fucking weird.
It is weird.
How much in this fucking movie seems to have, like, predicted the future.
We'll get into that. But the rundown is that
Somebody's moving in next door.
Rundown is that a company of American soldiers in the Korean War, and I believe it's 1952, a company that includes Lawrence Harvey and Frank Sinatra, their characters are Raymond Shaw and Captain Marcos, Benjamin Marcos, I believe, respectively. They're both in this company. I believe Raymond Shaw is the, like, leader, right?
Yeah.
Or he is the highest rank, I suppose. This company of men is betrayed by their Chinese or Korean translator, who's a part of them. He sells them out, basically, to be ambushed by the communist forces. The company of men is then subjected to a brainwashing experience over an undetermined amount of time, where they essentially, we get this incredible scene, really, where they are all sitting in what first appears to be like a ladies like meeting in like a flower shop, like a floral society type meeting, like red hat ladies thing.
The woman is talking about like how to care for like hydrangeas.
Yeah,
and the camera does this fucking slow turn over the away from like the podium over the audience of all these like old women sitting there and listening, and it turns back and there's like a guy like transcribing like notes or whatever. Yeah. And the stage is like changed, and there's these big fucking like blown up pictures of like Stalin and Mao in the background. Yep. And it's like this, and, like Chinese, like, and like there's like a Chinese guy standing there and talking to like an audience of like communist like generals and stuff. Mm-hmm. About like the brainwashing thing. It's fucking awesome.
It is one of the like, I mean, there are two standout moments in this movie to me, which is this scene and the ending, and we'll get to the ending. But this scene was fucking awesome.
The way so the great, editing, dude.
Like every cut is like this, becomes this like amalgam of these two different like of this like facade that the soldiers are experiencing of the like ladies in the greenhouse and the actual reality of the communist like operatives like presentation, where it's like you might get the like woman elaborating on these like plans to like invade the West or yeah. whatever to this audience of like older women, or you might get like this Chinese like sort of scientist, or I guess he's like a psychologist leader guy giving this presentation to a room full of like flowers and shit, and it's like the way that it keeps like cutting in and out between these so like things good. Is awesome. But so they undergo this brainwashing treatment, which we come to learn Raymond Shaw is the primary subject of it. He is the quote unquote Manchurian candidate that we learn. He's been brainwashed to see, when he sees certain symbols, specifically the Queen of Diamonds, to basically unlock a sort of fugue state for himself, of what he had been sort of conditioned into being taught by the communists, and to then enact their plans, which involve high level assassination of American political figures in order to further entrench their power in American society in a way that they have sort of deemed productive to their cause. So Raymond Shaw, so this occurs and they are returned home. Raymond Shaw is given the Medal of Honor. They're all under the same story of what happened. None of them really aware yet of what really happened to them. Captain Marcos, or Raymond Shaw's mother, Angela Lansbury, whose name is Eleanor, I believe. Yeah. Eleanor. She is married to a just fucking idiot of a man. Johnny Eisland is his name.
And you could not make a more obvious, like, Joe McCarthy.
Yeah.
Like, stand-in.
Yeah.
Literally standing up in front of the fucking press and being like, I have a list of 100 Department of Defense people that are card-carrying members of the Communist Party. Or whatever, like that's like the catalyst basically yeah. for the plot.
So that is Raymond Shaw's stepfather, and he is an idiot, and it's very clear from the jump that Eleanor is the one who has far grander designs on Raymond Shaw and on her husband and on herself in her pursuit of power. Marcos ends up, he's having these terrible nightmares about the brainwashing that he doesn't really understand, where he sees Raymond Shaw choking one of his company men to death and shooting them, which did happen. But he's freaking out. He's like, what the fuck's going on? He's having a hard time. He's running PR for the Department of Defense, actually, whenever Johnny Eisland is making this big elaborate show of, there are 200... communists in the Department of Defense, and then after which that scene was cool too.
That was fucking awesome.
That was a great scene.
Which is like, because like the way that Frankenheimer is like framing this stuff happening, it's like a we see, like, the, there's, like, these normal shots of, like, the Secretary of Defense, I believe, and Marcos just, like, sitting at this desk taking questions from reporters. He's like, all right, one last question, and then we'll wrap it up. And then we see, like, these shots, like, buried in the audience of, like, Eleanor is there, and there's, like, a TV set there, and in the background you can see it, like, Johnny, like, stand up, and he's, and, like, on the TV set we can see, like, the camera, like, cut to him.
Yeah.
Or whatever, so we're seeing him simultaneously in the background and on the TV in the foreground, and, like, there's, like, a sort of, not a reverse shot, but there's, like, a paired shot with that of, like, the same sort of setup of, like, Marcos and the secretary at their desk, and then, like, a TV in the foreground or whatever, and we can see, like, what's happening, like, right to the left. It's so fucking cool.
It is a really cool fucking scene.
Like, it's kind of insane to just, like, to pull the audience's, like, attention in so many different directions at once, because it's like, okay, I'm looking at the TV, I'm looking at Johnny Eyes, and I'm looking at Eleanor right now, and I'm looking at
Marco.
And, like, the media is just, like, exploding all around us, yeah, or whatever, and it's like, there's so much to take in. It's, like, such an overload of information, but it's, like, super effective at doing that, and I feel like that's kind of, like, what the point is that, like, yeah, okay, we're just being, like, bombarded with this, like, information.
This, like, spectacle.
That we don't really know how to, like, actually deal with it.
And it's very quickly apparent that, you know, these claims are completely ludicrous that Eisen is making, and they're more or less just an attempt to raise his own profile to eventually, what will happen later, to eventually assume or win the nomination for vice president of the Republican nominee for presidency, which is occurring, the election is occurring in this time as well. So then Marco, you know, he gets off of that. He's terrible at PR. His, like, supervisor, like, tells him, you're fucking awful at this. He links up with the intelligence community, which has also linked up with one of his company men who's having similar nightmares of, like, the same exact nightmares, basically.
That was such a great touch, I thought, because this other guy that's having nightmares or whatever, he's black. And in, like, the dreams that he's having, in the, like, sort of hypnotized, like, hallucination that he has, then all of the women at the, like, flower show are black.
Are black, yeah.
Yep.
Yep, that was, I also noticed that. I was like, damn, okay, wait.
Like, that's such a great fucking touch that, like,
yep,
everybody's sort of hypnotic state is, like, individualized.
Yeah.
Which to them,
that was really cool. So he links up with this guy who, he's a minor character, he doesn't really linger around very long. Links up with him, though, they determine, like, hey, there's some truth to this. So then Marco is an agent of the intelligence community to figure out what the fuck happened to us in Korea. And how is Shaw involved in this? Raymond Shaw, at this point, is a bona fide agent of the communists without realizing it. The man conducting the presentation during the brainwashing meets him and activates him, basically. That to kill a minor target to ensure that he is, like, under their control still.
Whenever, so this was after, like, the hit and run stuff, right? Where, like, Shaw apparently gets, like, hit by a car or whatever and goes to the doctors to, like, recover. Which happens, like, off screen or whatever. It's not really important. But then, like, the psychologist and then, like, another, like, a different, like, Soviet guy that's been planted in the U.S. in Washington, they're just, like, chopping it up in the fucking hospital room, man. It's so crazy because they're doing a set.
Yeah, and Shaw is completely conscious during all. Well, no, he's, I mean, not conscious. He's, like, in his activated state.
It was so weird because there's something that the fucking psychologist says. I forget what it is, but I was like, these guys are doing, like, their comedy bit right now. And it's so fucking strange.
It is very,
not the last time that the tone is just going to be completely wild in this fucking movie.
So they activate Shaw, he gets out of the hospital, and he actually kills his boss, who is the, quote, minor target, which also serves to, Raymond Shaw is working with a newspaper at this point, and it serves to get him into a higher status in the media, which also works to the communist benefit. So that goes on. Marco is doing his investigation, he runs into this woman on the train who is
Janet Leigh.
What's her name? She has a weird ass name.
Eugenie Rose.
Because I thought she was saying eugenics, and I was like, what the fuck kind of name is that? But she was like, it's French. She's weird, and I want to get back to her later.
All right, well, then let's hurry this up.
Okay, she's bizarre. Marco encounters her on a train, and I guess they become a thing very quickly. Like an item, I should say. He is starting to uncover. He's encountering Shaw more and more, and sort of uncovering that, like, hey, this dude is like fucked up, like bad. His wires are crossed, and this is bad. And they eventually actually figure out that like playing solitaire, and the Queen of Diamonds specifically is like an activation trigger for his like conditioning. They're able to do that. There is a sort of a subplot of Shaw and his sort of like sweetheart lover before he left for Korea. Their relationship was ruined by his mother for claiming that his sweetheart's name is Jocelyn Jordan. Eleanor claimed that Jocelyn's father, a sitting senator as well, is like a communist, basically. And he's like a very like kind, seeming like good natured dude who's just like,
well, he's got his head on the shoulders.
Yeah, he's like, well, she's crazy, I guess, but you're all right, Mr. Shaw, Raymond Shaw. You're a fine young man. So they are a couple, and but ruined by Raymond's mother. So Raymond hates his mom. Before he goes out to war. So these things all kind of like come to a head in this party that Eleanor throws. Jocelyn is back. She happens to be dressed up as the Queen of Diamonds, which activates Raymond.
I got picked up.
And then the plot is kind of revealed, where Eleanor takes Senator Jordan aside and asks him if he will block Johnny Eisland's nomination. And at this point, then we learn that Eleanor is making a power play to get Johnny to be the vice president of the United States.
That's right.
And Jordan says, I will do whatever I can in my power to stop you, you mad power bitch. And Eleanor's like, okay. So Raymond, activated, goes to Jordan's house, kills him, kills Jocelyn. His purpose is revealed to him by his mother, that his mother is a communist handler, or is his handler in the States for the communists, that she is going to use Raymond Shaw to assassinate the Republican nominee for president during his acceptance speech at the RNC. So then Johnny Eisman springs up, picks up the president's or the nominee's dead body, gives a rousing speech, coasts to the win in the election, where Eleanor now is the First Lady of the United States, who is really running the show. And she is pissed off that the communists used Raymond as the sleeper cell agent. She didn't know that whenever she signed up with them, but she's pissed at them, so she's going to, once she gets in power, she's going to flip things against the communists once she's in her position with Eisland as president. So that's Raymond's whole thing. Marco intervenes, is able to be like, hey, Queen of Diamonds, here's a deck full of fucking Queen of Diamonds. We're getting past all the walls we can, which I thought that was funny.
I'm done with the bullshit.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny, though. It was just more Queen of Diamonds would get us deeper into your mind. He gets in there, though, on behalf of the well-being of the nation, and is like, don't fucking do this. Like, do not assassinate the president, Raymond. And he's like, okay, I won't. Day comes that it's the RNC. They take a break. 9:30 is when the president is expected to, or the nominee is expected to accept the nomination. Raymond, dressed up as a priest, gets up into the white room. He's got his sniper rifle. He's got that shit pointing down at the president while he's speaking. There's a specific line in the speech he's supposed to wait until after is spoken to shoot him. The line comes. The nominee coughs in the middle of it. Oh, Marco knows something is wrong. He's there at the RNC to make sure everything's square. He knows something's up. He's racing up to the light room where Shaw is. It's all very intense. The nominee continues the speech after the line, and then bang, Shaw, single shot right through Johnny Eisland's head. Bang, another shot. He kills his mother right next to Eisland. Marco breaks into the room. He's like, Shaw, what the fuck are you doing, man? Shaw, I forget what he says at the end there, but he turns...
Well, he tells him that, like, listen, I was the only one that could stop them. That's why I didn't, call you, after, whenever it was, before the convention or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he fucking kills himself.
He turns the gun on himself, kills himself. And that's kind of the end of the movie.
Yeah,
Marco has a brief little monologue at the end. I remember really liking it as a closing note, but...
I don't really remember what he says.
I don't remember what he says either there. But, goddamn, that's the end of that movie.
Right.
Just kind of twists and twists and twists. The last, 20 minutes or so, I was like, holy shit, is going on?
Yeah, I think that, for me, it's, from probably the beginning up to... I don't know, the press conference or whatever, where Eisland, makes his claim.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a little early, but somewhere around there. Up to there, and then from, whenever Shaw kills Senator Jordan and his wife, then to the end. I think that shit is, excellent
stuff. It really is whenever awesome.
That scene where he kills Jordan is fucking, brutal.
Yeah, there's the shot of
Jordan standing there with the carton of milk, and he's trying to talk to him. He's trying to figure out what the fuck Shaw is doing. He's like, hey man, are you okay here? Why do you have a gun? Whatever. And then just silent fucking bullet through the fucking milk carton into his heart, and he just falls down or whatever. That shit is chilling.
And the shot of him shooting it is this weird upturned shot, and you can see this American Eagle crest on the wall right behind his head, and it's whoa, okay. I really like this movie though a lot.
I think it's kind of a mess ultimately. Let's get to the fucking train scene.
Okay,
because
I'm
this is
glad to get into
completely
it.
This is one of the most insane dialogue exchanges I think I've ever seen in a movie. Is absolutely absurd, because Janet Leigh, and I don't dislike it, but it's just so strange,
right? It is utterly bizarre when you're watching it.
I wish I remembered what she was saying, because Janet Leigh is trying to Marco is sitting there wherever, he's sweating fucking bullets.
Oh,
he is out of his element,
fucking stressed
right now. He is going through it, and Janet Leigh is just sitting there, and she's trying to make small talk with him or whatever, and she keeps lobbing out these jokes or whatever, these little quips, and they just with a thud. Every single one of them misses, and every time she says them and they get zero reaction from Marco, then she always just looks down and looks away and is it's hysterical to just watch this woman absolutely clunk her fucking way into
coming on to this guy. I have, so I'm on IMDb right now. I have some of
quotes. The one line I remember is, "Are you Arabic? Put another way, are you married?"
Yeah.
What the fuck does that mean, man?
Marco also asked her in this exchange, "You in the railroad business?" And she goes, "Not anymore. However, if you will permit me to point out, when you ask that question, you really should say, are you in the railroad line?" And it's I don't know what that means at all. I don't know what the Arabic thing means at all. I don't know what the married thing means at all. And she
it's just so crazy.
It is absolutely bizarre. And she keeps going, she keeps repeating her address and goes,
yep,
El Dorado 19770. And I don't know what the fuck that means either, and apparently Marco does. Here's my...
I think it's a zip code.
What would El Dorado be, though?
Like, the building, I guess. Like, the hotel she was at or whatever.
Here is my theory. And I think this is gonna segue us into the broader discussion of this movie, I think. Here is my theory on this character, because she exists in the rest of the movie. Like, oh, also, it should be said.
Not really. She, like, has, like, there's, like, two scenes with her later on. One where she's like, yeah, I fucking left my husband at the altar or whatever because I fell in love with you on the fucking train.
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, sure, man, whatever.
Exists is maybe a weird word because she is very much not a participant in the events at all of what continues. But she's in the background. From this scene forward, she is, like, weirdly just, like, around the characters and, like, the events, specifically Marco, in a way that, like, is not really meaningful at all. Like, she doesn't actually add anything to the story whatsoever.
I mean, it feels like she either, like, this, like, Janet Leigh's character was, like, shoehorned in, like, after, like, the script had been finished, I was like, okay, like, we need some sort of, like, sex appeal here, so throw Janet Leigh in. I mean, like, post-Psycho, then Janet Leigh was a pretty big movie star. And, I mean, pre-Psycho as well. But, or the alternative is, like, that there is, like, something more with her that just totally got cut out. Which I think is probably more likely.
I think that's more likely. I think, and here's what I'm going to say, and this is kind of, there is not much in the movie that I'm basing this on, other than the kind of, like, the style and the atmosphere that the movie is working in, that I'm going to theorize here. And I don't think that this is probably not, like, an unheard of theory on this movie, but I think Janet Leigh is a handler in the same way that Eleanor is. Because there is no other explanation for why the fuck she is so bizarre. Why, what she, like, it sounds like she is talking, truly talking in code to Marco. Like, in a way, like, in a way that does not register as any sort of meaning to anybody other than, like, who it would be meaningful to. Like, the repetition, she says, like, El Dorado, 19770, like, five fucking times on the train to him, and, like, that does not mean anything to the audience at this point, and it doesn't mean anything after the point either. Like, it does not mean anything. It is,
I mean, it's like, well, I guess he fucking remembered her address.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Like, you're telling me this woman, like, just, and, like, I get it, like, 50s, like, romance filmmaking, you know, whatever, is what it is. The idea of a woman being whisked away by a stranger on the train is, like, certainly not something unseen, but it's fucking bizarre, like, how this is, like, implemented in this movie. But this movie is so, like, seeping, like, just saturated in, like, this paranoia and this, like, feeling of, like, just uneasiness of, like, conspiratorial sort of, like, underpinnings to everything that's going on, that, like, this character, and this could totally be just reading too far into it because for what is otherwise a completely purposeless character. Like, you know, that's certainly a possibility. But this movie is so paranoid about everything and so just, like, on edge about every one of its characters and one of its, like, plot points that, like, I struggle to look at Janet Leigh's character in this and say, oh, she's definitely just, like, a fucking weirdo or just a throwaway. Like, I refuse to believe that she is a throwaway character, and given her relationship with Marco, I feel like it isn't totally out of the realm of possibility that she is, like, operating in the same role of, like, Eleanor is to Raymond Chaw, being, like, a handler for the, like, communists of the East, I suppose, for their American Manchurian candidates in the form of Marco and Raymond Chaw. Well, and it's, like, to what extent, to what point that would be building to, like, I'm not really sure, but I'm not really sure that it matters so much as just suffuses, continues to, like, build on this, like, the conspiratorial, like, designs of the movie.
I think that that is, like, fair, is that, like, oh, this movie is so much about, like, the atmosphere that it creates, that, like, somebody, that it is fully plausible that, like, somebody just coming up to you, like, a pretty lady coming up and talking about
railway lines and railway businesses and shit. El Dorado on the train, and then suddenly you start dating and living together. Whatever, there's a reason to take that with suspicion, I guess. Yeah. But I think the thing is that, like, it doesn't fucking matter if she is or not, because it doesn't, like, none of, like, her character has, like, zero impact on the plot.
Yeah.
In, like, the second half of the movie. So it's like, okay, well, she may have been a earlier draft of the script, maybe she was, like, another, like, sweeper agent for the communists, and that shit doesn't pan out at all in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think is kind of the thing with this movie for me, at least, there's a review on Letterboxd, right? I think it was by Mike D'Angelo, who is, like, the film critic at the LA Times, I think. And I think he put it in a way that I really liked, where it's like, it's not really a coherent thing, right? It's like not, it's better taken as like a series of like, as like individual like sequences or whatever of just like fucking great filmmaking, great like suspense and like, excuse me, experimentation and whatever. As a whole, it's kind of a mess. I think of the scene where Jocelyn comes in with the fucking Queen of Diamonds costume on. He's like, come the fuck on, man. I think that the whole, like, Queen of Diamonds device also is kind of, like, was, like, solitaire, like, a bigger, like, cultural thing back in the 60s, in the early 60s than it is now? Because fucking everybody in this damn movie is like, here, you look stressed, play some solitaire. Pulls out a fucking deck of cards out of my pocket. Like, what the hell is going on, man? I mean, it makes sense for, like, Eleanor or whatever, but, like, the bartender just has, like, fucking stacks of cards behind me. He's like, here, stranger. So that's sort of weird. That whole, like, party scene was just fucking weird, too. Like, this movie moves from tone to tone in just, like, absolute whiplash. The, like, flashback scene of Shaw talking about, like, his sort of courtship of Jocelyn or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, like, pleasant stuff and, like, helped define his relationship with his mother and his relationship with Jocelyn and stuff, and like his own character or whatever, because Shaw is like kind of this guy, like there's a joke here that like everybody in this platoon that got hypnotized or whatever, whenever somebody asks them, what do you think of Raymond Shaw, then they say the same like canned thing of like,
Raymond Shaw is the kindest, bravest, warmest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life.
Yeah, and like nobody actually thinks that, because Raymond Shaw is like an asshole that prick. Everybody kind of hates. But the tonal switches here are just fucking insane and don't really work for me at all. But it's fascinating to just, like, take them out of, like, the broader... take these, like, individual moments out of the broader context of the film and just, like, look at them and be like, can you believe this fucking ending? This is awesome. Can you believe this fucking train scene? This is the wildest thing I've ever seen. And this is the most... There is, like, Lord of the Rings fucking orc dialogue that is more realistic than how these people are talking to each other right now.
And it really, I mean, for what it's worth, I feel like it's just that scene that the performances are like, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, I think the rest of the movie, like, is very well acted and very, like, well written, I would say. Actually, no, there's an exception, which is the scene where Marco is fighting, Chunjin, or whatever his name is.
That fight scene was so bad. That was awesome, wasn't it? Man.
We're like Pink Panther shit.
That was so bad.
There's,
like, one good, like, stunt in it, and, you know, coincidentally, you didn't see Marco's face for that, so I guess Frank Sinatra was just not really willing to put his body through the paces for that one.
I think the movie works really, really fucking great as a satire, like, as the satire of McCarthyism,
so
the satire of, like, I guess just, like, I don't even know, because its politics are, like, weird and
it's
like
kind of, it's also kind of a, like, an ideological mess as well. Yeah, but like, I think that's like, that's part of what makes this such a fucking interesting movie. Is that like,
yeah,
obviously there's like all sorts of Red Scare stuff here of like, oh my god, the and I think that like
Chinese people or Chinese armed military, like, brainwashing U.S. soldiers or whatever was, like, a myth that had been circulating around since the Korean War had ended or whatever. And so it obviously plays into, like, these Red Scare, like, fantasies of, like, oh, my God, the communists are breaking our, like, people apart. They are infiltrating our society. Yeah. They're going to destroy us from within.
Which was the entire thrust of, like, real-life McCarthyism.
Yeah. But it's also, like, the actual sort of ideological forces, like, in combat that, like, makes up, like, the first third of this movie is pretty absent through the, like, I mean, it's absent in a sort of geopolitical sense scale in throughout, like, the second, throughout the latter portion of the film, because, like, we don't see any actual, like, Communist Party members.
Mm-hmm.
Past, like, whenever fucking the Soviet guy and the Chinese dude are just, like, chopping, shooting the shit or whatever in the hospital. I think that's the last scene that they're in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever.
Yeah, it is.
And that's, like, relatively early on. Like, past that, then it's, like, okay, the sort of, like, we've established the sort of, like, boogeyman here that, like, oh, these guys are out there and they have, like, infiltrated people in society. And what happens from the rest of that point, from that point on, is, like, American society just tearing itself apart.
Yeah.
In, like, the face of this, like, fear.
I think that's totally
which is, like, right. Interesting. I mean, McCarthyism is obviously a big part of that. It's, like, okay, well, we are just, like, destroying ourselves here. And then also the fact that, like, the loudest, like, communist accuser, Eleanor, is
an agent
herself, like, a subversive element that is, like, undermining society is, like, fascinating stuff.
Like, I think that's, number one, just a fucking awesome twist that I really did not see coming, like, at all throughout this movie. But I think, like, that's, like, really what it's shooting for is, like, this sort of hysteria, like, that it's satirizing in the form of McCarthyism. And it's depicting it through Eleanor and Johnny Eisenman. Like, that hysteria leading to, like, basically just, like, a death spiral of, like, conspiratorial objective on top of conspiratorial objective on top of power grab on top of, like, assassination attempt. And, like, it's just, like, a ever sort of, like, declining, like, state of power in that we see, like, the agents in this country, like, taking part in order to, like, it that is, like, more or less, like, set off by an event that really is not really delved into at all, which is the Korean War. Like, that is, we get one scene, basically, of the company in Korea, and, like, for, like, 3 minutes, and we really don't spend any more time in the movie discussing that. Mm-hmm. But that, like, that single scene has set off basically a psychosis in the in the movie and in the country of hysteria on really, like, and I don't know what that says about, like, I don't know what John Frankenheimer's personal politics are. I don't get the sense that he's, like, a communist from this movie, because, like, I think more than anything he is,
there's,
like, his objective is satirizing that precise, like, hysteria of, like, saying, like,
the American, like, cultural,
yeah,
like, temperature.
Like, not necessarily saying, like, I'm a communist and you guys are fucking, like, look at yourself, you're ridiculous. It's more just saying, like, look at what you were doing. Like, look at what the hell this country is becoming. Look at what the state of politics in America is, that we have these wild accusations of ideological dissent being led to conspiracies, being led to assassinations of political figures. And it's like, and once again, like, put in context of, like, the rest of the 60s, like, this movie is even fucking wilder, like, in that specific, like, thematic regard.
Like, we're tearing each other apart looking for, like, shadows or whatever.
Yeah, and, like, exactly.
In the film, then, you know, the shadows are given shape or whatever, and they do exist around there, but it's the act of, like, tearing, like, self-destruction that is, like, given most attention. And, like, it's crucial that, like, Eleanor is, like, the sort of key figure that this whole thing pivots on, and, like, that she is also, like, indistinguishably American or whatever. In fact, like, a louder American than most people in this film. Maybe not, like, maybe louder than even their husband.
I think the movie does a really, like, clever, like, sort of meta thing about, like, just brainwashing in general. Because, like, while that's the, like, single, like, most famous, important narrative, like, event of this movie is the brainwashing, like, there's a broader kind of, like, I'd like to think intentional sort of, like, observation, I guess, it's making in that this movie is just seeped in fucking American imagery. In, like, mm-hmm. the Islands house is, like,
oh my
full
God,
of, like, American flags, American, the like, Abraham. Bald eagles. Abraham Lincoln is everywhere in this movie. Like,
yeah, he is.
In like, the iconographic, like, sense. Like, the beard and the hat and, like, busts of him everywhere are, yep. like, just constantly throughout. And, like, the constant, like, imagery that we associate with America and with American politics of, like, bald eagles, flags, like, the troops. Like, it's everywhere in this movie. And, like, in a sense, like, I mean, hell, in, like, Raymond Shaw's, like, moment of, like, cold-blooded murder, then he is, like, backdropped by a, what, in the moment, appears like a fascist-looking fucking crest of a bald eagle. But that, like, outside that moment, it's just a bald eagle, right? And it's, like, this weird, like, I think it's very, like, clever, like, trick that this movie's pulling of, like, the broader, like, brainwashing of our symbols and, like, iconography of, like, the American, like, mythos, I suppose, that, like, we have, like, characters here that it are, like, brainwashed and that are then under their, not under their own free will in their actions or their motives. And it's, like, you can see that in, like, other characters that aren't brainwashed or aren't quote-unquote brainwashed, like, in Johnny Island and in, like, Eleanor and others. And, like, I think it's very clever how it does that.
So this, there's, like, two sort of, like, genres, I think, that are interesting for me to consider here with this movie. And one is, like, I think that it pulls a similar, like, maneuver for, like, the war film. Because, like, say what you will about it, this is, like, essentially, like, a war film. It might be, like, psychic warfare and, like,
Cold warfare.
Yeah. But it is, like, still about, like, geopolitical conflict.
For sure.
It pulls a similar thing for that as, like, Psycho did for the horror film, where it is, like, taking the abstract, like, other, like, enemy forces and, like, placing them back home, which, like, it's ironic that Janet Leigh is in both pictures, but, like, the communists exist or whatever, and they are posed as a threat here. A threat against, like, American society and American, you know, individuals and things like that. But, like, it is not them that is, like, doing the direct damage here. It is, yeah. like, it is American people and politicians and stuff that are doing damage to themselves or whatever. So it's essentially, like, a warfare in against it, like, oh, it's, like, a self-reflexive, like, warfare, basically, in some ways. It is almost, like, especially in that scene where Shaw, like, kills the Jordans or whatever, then it definitely is just, like, shot like a horror movie.
Yeah.
Where he's just this, like, Lawrence Harvey is a tall-ass man. He's a big dude here, and he is just, like, looming in these fucking doorways in this, like, black suit with the silenced revolver at his side or whatever, and just, like, that shot of, like, Jordan, like, that shot of, like, the revolver in, like, close-up with Jordan in the in, like, the background of the kitchen or whatever is just, like, terrifying. But also the other sort of genre that I think about with this, and is a lot more obvious, is, like, this feels like the birth of, like, the political thriller.
Yeah.
Right? Like, through the 70s or whatever, it was kind of the high watermark for this style of movie. And it's, like, some people, there are some, like, directors that are synonymous with it, right? Like, J. Pakula or whatever did All the President's Men and what else did he do? I mean, he did The Parallax View, which, like, is basically a direct riff on this, but without, like, the sort of foreign influences in it, including up to, like, and including the climax and the ending.
Damn, spoilers.
It's not the same ending, but
oh, okay.
they both conclude in a convention setting.
Oh.
Yeah. But yeah, this feels like the genesis of this particular brand of like paranoia, politics, like violence or whatever. And it, obviously like the stuff that happens later, the later sort of iterations of this genre are a lot more focused on like the domestic sort of paranoia, right? With CIA and Nixon and like the FBI and all sorts of this stuff.
I mean, even then you get kind of like a watered down version of just like actor X has is motivated by X domestic issue or whatever, and it's like, yeah, what's interesting, kind of more, just more watered down. You get the kind of unfortunate of just like, oh, they just want power, the ambiguous, they want power, like, motivation that kind of comes to dominate the genre in the, like, in recent years, I find. But this is not that.
Yeah, this is a very particular, like, style of this stuff that, like, has a lot of imitators to it. And some, I think, do it better, some do it worse, of course. But it's fascinating to see, like, the beginning of all this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't, like, I'm sure that there are probably other films that, like, well, actually, like, I don't even know. Like, I'm trying to think, like, were there, like, movies before this that were, like, so about, like, politics and paranoia and, like, subversion and things like that.
I'm not sure. You would know that better than me.
Yeah, I'm having a tough time thinking of it. I mean, it's partially because I think the cultural, like, the actual societal atmosphere was so, like, charged with that stuff. And, like, through the 70s and stuff and these later genre iterations, then there's a lot more meat to work through here.
Yeah.
With, like, JFK and RFK and Watergate and things like that. There's a lot more domestic sort of domestic subversion that is going on that you can riff on. And Manchurian Candidate is, like, predictive of all that. Or it's not really predictive, but it is existing in advance of all that, in anticipation almost of that kind of, like, growing sort of atmosphere. Interesting sort of place in history that it has.
Yeah, on the poster for it on IMDb, this is a hilarious, like, subtitle for it. It says, the poster says it, which also, like, you know, mid-century, like, movie posters were wilding out.
They were awesome.
Constantly. They were telling you fucking everything you need to know. But on the Manchurian Candidates, it says, if you come in 5 minutes after this picture begins, you won't know what it's all about.
Like, like, what?
Okay. Which also, that's not true at all. Like,
what? That's
so weird. Like, I guess you'll miss the, like, ambush scene, but
you should have done the Hitchcock thing. Frankenheimer should have, where, like, you can't, you bar entry from people coming in late.
Yeah.
For Psycho.
There you go. Alright. Do we have anything else to add?
Oh, the part where at the party, there's, like, a shot where, it's after, Eleanor talks to Tom Jordan. Jordan's like, yeah, no, I'm gonna, like, shoot down your husband's nomination or whatever with everything in my power. And there's a shot where she grabs, like, the deck of cards out of the desk drawer and is, like, and says something, I forget what she says, but then it just, like, cut, like, dissolves out. There's a lot of great dissolves in this also. I don't know if you noticed that. But it just, like, dissolves out into another scene. And I remember watching that, and I had two thoughts. I was like, one, okay, from, like, a writer standpoint, this annoys the shit out of me. Because it's not revealed until, like, 15, 20 minutes later that Eleanor is, like, Shaw's handler or whatever. So she would know that the Queen of Diamonds is, like, the brainwashing trigger. But at this time, it's, like, I was watching it, I was like, okay, this pisses me off. How the fuck would she know that she needs to play, show her son fucking playing cards to, like, get him to do what she wants?
Yeah.
Which makes sense later, of course. But then the other part of me was like, oh my god, this would be brilliant if this is such a brilliant, like,
what we were talking about earlier, like, thematic sort of choice to be, like, Shaw is no longer even, like, a real, like, agent of the communists anymore. He is just, like, a brainwashed puppet at the disposal of whoever, like, picks up the strings.
Yeah.
Or whatever. In this case, it's Eleanor, who has, isn't really operating, like, ideologically. She's just, like, doing it for, like, personal power reasons or whatever, which is not the case. Obviously, she is doing it for ideological reasons, but for a moment there, I was like, oh, that's genius. it was like a twin reaction, like, this is genius, but also, come the fuck on. You gotta be shitting me. Why does everybody know this fucking trick? This one cool trick to control your veteran son. Cause assassinations. I cannot actually stress enough how good Lawrence Harvey is in this movie.
Yeah, he was awesome.
He's fantastic.
He died young.
All right.
Pretty cool.
Oh, you know what's weird? I read that John Frankenheimer was actually with RFK on the day that he was assassinated.
No fucking way.
Yeah.
Man, he must be so fucking done with this shit. He's like, damn it, I did not mean to bring this into the world. It is, no, I think this movie is really, really good. I honestly really liked it a lot. I think it's got style, it's got panache, it's got some awesome acting in it. It is a real kind of scattershot story that goes all over the place, but I was with it from the beginning. I was into it.
Hey, man, I'm hip to it.
Yeah, it never lost me. Never lost my investment in it, I should say, because there was definitely times where I was like, what the fuck is going on? And I will die thinking that Janet Leigh is a sleeper communist in this fucking movie, dude. I literally will not accept any so other possible weird explanation for her behavior. But that was really good. Really, really fucking really good satire, I thought.
Any final thoughts? Watch The Parallax View.
Oh. Well, maybe I will. Okay. Sucker.
It's a great movie. Yeah, no. I enjoyed it.
Cool, cool. Well, that's probably gonna do it for our episode then. Stay tuned in the future. Anything coming up that we're gonna...
We're almost there with Dragon Ball. We've been saying it every fucking episode, but
yeah,
we actually are now.
We are close. So keep an eye out for that. Keep an eye out for anything else. Alrighty. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Keep it sleazy.